This is my story.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and you're listening to This Is My Story, a special season of Impolite Company. Each week, we'll be joined by a woman who was once solidly rooted in the world of conservative white Christianity, but whose faith in politics have since shifted. She'll tell us that story, about what convicted her to see loving her neighbor as a commandment to shape not only how she lives her life, but also how she votes. In this first episode, I'm talking with Megan Westra, Milwaukee-based pastor and writer. Megan grew up in Appalachia, in the kind of evangelical community where sometimes kids rededicated themselves to Christ before they were even out of elementary school, because you can never be too sure. She is the author of a new book called Born Again and Again, Jesus' Call to Radical Transformation. It takes a hard look at the stories so many of us were taught about Christianity, unravels them, and then puts them back together with refreshingly practical suggestions for both churches and individuals who are looking to embody a different kind of Christianity. As Lisa Sharon Harper says in her foreword to the book, Megan invites those disillusioned by a white Jesus to be born again. Again. And in Megan's case, that may technically be born again, again, again. But I'll let her tell it. This is her story.
So I was born and raised right on the West Virginia-Virginia border, so in the Appalachian Mountains, so Bible Belt, a little bit further north than like the heart of the Bible Belt, but still definitely in that part of the country. The very first church experience I had was we went to a United Methodist congregation for the first 10 years of my life. That my great-grandparents had helped found. So I was super, super churched, going to the United Methodist Church on Sundays, but then I went with a friend to an Awana program at their Baptist church. And so, I was a kid of the South in the 90s. If there was a church thing, I was there, church camps and church whatever. I was there all the time. And in my book, I talk about how I got saved for the first time when I was 4 years old. Apparently, I don't remember that, but that's what my mom always told me. And so just from the get-go, I do not have memories outside of a life that was steeped in some kind of faith. Now, granted, growing up, it was this very traditionally evangelical, altar calls at the end of every service. If you were driving home from church tonight and you got in a car accident, do you know where you would go, right? That kind of rhetoric, and very much defined by all of the markers that we've become affiliated with since 2016, as far as what are the things that evangelicals really care about? And it's we want somebody who says that they oppose abortion. And I want to be real clear that they say they oppose abortion.
And were those messages okay. In terms of what the political priorities were, or cultural priorities, were those explicit, or are those things you just pick up from being in the community?
That we should support pro-life candidates and only pro-life candidates, Republican candidates, only Republican candidates, was pretty explicit from really early on in my life. I remember being I don't remember exactly how old, but I was in elementary school still, and I was watching Nickelodeon with my cousins at my grandparents' house, and there was a kids' election poll. I don't even remember who was running. It was one of the Clinton terms, so I don't remember if it was his first term or his second term, but it was, you still called in on your, landline phone, because cell phones weren't a thing yet, and you press one to vote for one person and two to vote for the other. And my cousins both called in and voted for Bill Clinton, and I was like, I'm sorry, that's not allowed, right? That was my framework even as a young child, right? You're not allowed to do that and love Jesus.
So I love that you write about rededicating your life to Christ by the age of, what, 12?
Yes. Ripe old age of 12.
Yeah. You are not the first person I've talked to who kind of felt like they must have erred at some point and had to rededicate themselves at age 8 or 10 or 12. What was your sense of what was required of you as a Christian?
You know, I don't even know if I had a really strong sense of what that would have looked like, right? If somebody had sat 10-year-old me down and like told me my life, right? Was just like, well, Megan, you're in church 3 days a week and you help your parents with things and you go visit your grandparents, you know, all of the like little things that the kids do to try to be like good little humans. If somebody had sat me down and said all those things back to me and been like, what else would the Lord require of you? I don't think I could have even answered that question. It really more came down to the constant image of God that I was being fed by faith leaders, you know, from the pulpit on Sunday mornings, in Sunday school lessons, all of that, was that God was angry and needed to be appeased, right? Like that you had to accept Jesus into your heart and that, you know, God killed Jesus so that you could be like not even okay with God, like not that you'd be cool with God, but like God wouldn't burn you for forever because God killed God's son. And that's just a horrible story. Like, that's a terrible story.
Well, it's definitely not an uplifting story, that's for sure. You know, I really connected to the kind of catch 22 that you write about, that if you're a child who grows up in the church, there's a pretty good chance that you're already on the straight and narrow. And yet the church places such an emphasis on having a story of transformation. What do you do if there's no turnaround that has to be affected? I'm wondering, so you're a self-described super church kid. You've been saved multiple times. Where do you go from there? What is your thinking as you approach the end of high school?
I feel like I am kind of a stereotype in that, like, I kind of came up through youth group in a period where, as you were getting ready to go off to college, the assumption was like, well, when you get to college, your faith is going to be challenged. You're going to have to work really hard to not let the liberal, again, like air quotes, professors pull you away from God. And so be prepared to have to stand for your faith. Going into the university is essentially being persecuted. So be ready. And so I went to a small Christian college in part because that was like, well, if you want to be not completely dragged away, then you should go to a Christian college because it'll still be hard. You're still going to be, you know, pulled by the influences of the world and of academia, but at least you'll have, you know, some strong Christian professors who will be helping you. And so I went to a small Christian college there in my hometown, both because that's what seemed to make a lot of sense. And my parents really encouraged that. I didn't give a whole lot of thought to it beyond I need to be prepared to defend my faith, even on this small Christian college campus. And just assumed that, like, that would be what I had to do is, I would get there and there would be some professors that would be really supportive and there would be other professors that would try to, you know, lure me away. I remember my freshman year, all of us kind of whispering, those of us who were coming out of more fundamentalist backgrounds, like, oh, watch out for this one professor. Like, he doesn't believe in inerrancy. Like, you have to be careful in his class. And I just like laugh about that now because I'm like, oh man, I probably should have paid more attention in his class. I probably would have learned some really great things. But
it turns out that your faith was challenged in college, just not the way you had anticipated.
Not at all. No. So I started working at a nonprofit my freshman year and was helping with like after school programming, and the dynamics were really strange because my private Christian liberal arts college was about 5 minutes away from a part of town where there were kids growing up in houses that literally didn't have running water yet. Mm. You know, there in kind of rural Appalachia. And so it was this ridiculous juxtaposition of just so much wealth and privilege on the college campus. And then people who didn't have things that we don't even think of as basic necessities often in the United States, like running water, electric heat. And so I started working there and tutoring. And about halfway through my freshman year, it was just so difficult to reconcile what I thought was the gospel, what I thought God was doing in the world, with what I was actually witnessing in real time when I would go to work, that I quit. And I'm not proud of that, but I was having all of these questions and all of these, if they were doubts, I wouldn't have named them doubts at that point, but it was just like, I'm praying and I'm telling these people that Jesus died for their sins and they still don't have running water. What's up with that? And, you know, and I didn't have the framework at 18 years old to think through that in any other way than to say like, well, you know, either I am being disobedient and that's why I'm miserable, is like the Lord is convicting me and trying to get me back on a different path, or God's not here. So I quit because I had no idea how to reconcile things, and really had a bit of a crisis of faith over the next year of just not knowing how to sort through all that, because like, spoiler, you know, quitting the job and not being in that community anymore didn't mean that those doubts magically just disappeared. You know, that's a box that once you start to open it, it's real hard to shut again. Like, I did everything. I tried my best to just go like full on, I'm going to be the best Christian girl ever. Then came a campus Bible study leader and I started leading worship in a different campus band, and like just got so completely over involved in everything. Like, I joined a service sorority on campus, like just absurd, throwing myself into everything.
If someone had asked you at the time, what would have been your explanation for the poverty that you observed in the lives of the kids that you'd been working with in that job?
I mean, the narrative I grew up with around poverty was that it was the result of personal choices or moral failures. And so like, if you were poor, then it was your fault. And again, like, that was something that while I was working there, that was deeply challenged, right? That there were grandmothers who had spent their entire lives in church and were deeply devoted to the Lord and were constantly praying and just such loving people who were living in dire straits. And I couldn't square that, right? Like, and so I knew that what I grew up with this, like, well, if you're poor, it's your own fault. And if you just try hard enough, then you can make it. If you don't have your needs met, then you just need to go out and get a job or go get a second job. And so I knew that that wasn't true anymore, right? Like, based on experiences and the people that I knew and was working with, I was like, well, that's not true. But I didn't know what to replace that with. And I don't think I was even quite ready to completely let go of that narrative. It didn't seem like it lined up, but also like, people I deeply loved and trusted told me that explicitly or implicitly. And it's really challenging at any point in your life, but especially when you're still in your like early formative years, it's really challenging to look at parents and family members and beloved pastors and mentors and say, you told me the wrong thing. You taught me a framework that wasn't true and wasn't helpful and that causes harm to these other people that I love now too.
Did you have anyone you could go to with these questions at that point?
I had a really close mentor who worked at the nonprofit who, yeah, in retrospect, I'm like, my gosh, like, God bless that woman, because I would just show up in her office, a whole wreck of a 18, 19-year-old, and just explode with questions and frustrations. And so she was helpful in a lot of ways. I also had a professor who taught theology and philosophy on campus. And he would listen to my questions in class and then after class make recommendations for what else I could be reading. He's like, hey, you know, I know this is what's assigned on the syllabus, but based on the question that you asked today, you should read this. Like the best kind of teachers do, right? And so he helped on-ramp me into a lot of different places, right? Like he recommended that I read Ron Sider, Rich Christians in an Age of Wonder, wow, and things like that. Yeah. Which, like, you know, as a 19-year-old who only knew this, like, really narrow fundamentalist kind of faith, it blew my mind. I was like, oh, my gosh, somebody's thinking about this. You know, and then he's like, well, if you think that is helpful. And then he, like, was just like, yeah, go check out James Cohn. And I was like, oh. And so I'm really, really grateful that I had, you know, both this mentor at work who was kind of catching a lot of the emotional turmoil I was going through, and then also had this professor on campus who was breadcrumbing the way into a better way of thinking.
Tell me about the summer that you ended up with, is it Crusade for Christ?
It was Campus Crusade.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So I kept thinking that if I just kept doing more, then I would somehow arrive, or I would like make it, or everything would fall into place, or I would at least have some sort of like Amy Carmichael, Lottie Moon kind of epic missionary story that I could tell. And so I signed up to do a summer project with Crew and went to Santa Cruz, California, and went and lived there for the summer. And we were supposed to go to our jobs. We all had jobs on the boardwalk. And so I worked in a candy store, and we were all supposed to go to our jobs and try to build intentional relationships with our coworkers and have, you know, real spiritual conversations with our coworkers. And then on the weekends, we went downtown into the kind of towny part of Santa Cruz near the university, and we would stand on street corners and hand out little blue books with like the four spiritual laws, like you're a sinner and God is love, and you know, but God is going to send you to hell if you don't recognize that. and we were supposed to just try to talk to people on the corner and do street evangelism essentially. And I at that point had done enough work in the nonprofit that I worked at during college and different things like that, that I could see some cracks in the system. So I kind of drew myself toward people that were out on the street corners anyway, when I was supposed to be out talking to people. And so I would go and I would talk to the woman who was sitting there panhandling and like trying to ask for food or money or whatever. And if I had just gotten paid from my job, I would be like, well, let's just go get some Taco Bell and talk. They actually wanted to talk to someone. Most of the people that were walking through downtown on their way to like pick up pizza or go shop at the Gap were not interested in talking. They didn't really want to hear about how they were sinners on their way to dinner. But, you know, Bonnie and Andrea and some of the women who were, you know, on the street corner as well, like they were cool with talking. And so I talked with them, and we would get coffee or we would eat dinner together or whatever and just talk. And then I would try to bring them back to our little like crew compound, because we were also told, you know, if anybody like prays to receive Christ and they want to come back and eat dinner at the compound, like we'll always have enough food for a few guests. But then when I would try to bring back the women that I had been speaking to, I was like, well, no, you can't bring them back. That's not who we were trying to have you invite. And so there is this very explicit, like, not those people. We would like for you to go and try to invite other college students, you know, young married couples, families with kids. Like, that's okay, all okay. But people who are experiencing homelessness, you can't invite them to dinner. And I remember pushing back on project leadership even then to be like, this doesn't make any sense. I never got a good answer. That summer was really clarifying in a lot of ways. Like, I am grateful for the experience because it was like, well, that's not it, right? That was kind of how I walked away from that summer, was it was like formation by like negative experience. I know that is not what Jesus is like. And that really helped set some fire to my feet as far as trying to figure out what it actually looked like.
And that led you to Milwaukee?
It did. After college, then...
what would Jesus do? Jesus would move to Milwaukee?
Jesus would move to Milwaukee. Well, Jesus would move toward people who were suffering, would have been like the framework I would have used at that point. My husband, who is my fiance at that point, that last year that I was in college, he was a year ahead of me in school. He lived across the street from the nonprofit that I had worked at. So in the neighborhood where not everybody had running water and not everybody had heat. And the house he lived actually didn't have heat at first. He had to put baseboard heating into it. And that really shifted the way that both of us were thinking about the students that we worked with at the nonprofit. Because I was living in this fancy dorm on the private Christian college campus and was like, oh, let me go work with the least of these and come in and like be Jesus. And he was living in the same neighborhood and was like, no, the grandmother who lives next door, who's caring for her 7 grandkids in this house, she's Jesus. And we get to come alongside and bear witness and be formed by her. Mm. We knew we wanted to kind of continue on with being in proximity to people who were different from us, or had different life experiences than we did. And so we took jobs in Milwaukee as urban children's pastors was the job description at the time, which just makes me chuckle now. I would not take a job with that job description now. But that was the job description. And so we moved to Milwaukee and into a neighborhood that had been disinvested or underinvested in for probably the last 50 years or so. And we were going to move live in community. That was around the same time that Shane Claiborne's Irresistible Revolution came out. So it's like, yeah, we're going to live in community. We're going to live in the city. And, you know, there's a lot that I look back on from those early years that is kind of cringy now, thinking I could come in and fix things or that I had something to offer. But what I found was, yeah, that my neighbors are Jesus and that I have been formed more deeply by the ways that people have ministered to me in this place than anything I ever could have brought to this neighborhood.
I want to go back just for a few minutes to ask, while you were deconstructing and shifting your faith from the one you had been brought up in to one that is kind of more your own because you're becoming an adult in the world, how were you thinking politically at the same time? Was that something you were deconstructing as well?
It was. I remember, I think it was Obama's first term, so 2008. And I remember going to the polls, wearing my like social justice-y looking t-shirt and voting for McCain. Because I was like, I think that we should do social justice, but probably not in the ballot box, right? Like, but let the church be the church. Like, the church can do social justice and the government should just do government. So those were still very like separate in my mind. And then after that, I had such an awful feeling post that election. And I talk about this some in my book too, of kind of watching my coworkers and the students that I was working with at the nonprofit, most of whom were African American, and kind of watching the effects of the Obama inauguration on them and kind of having this like watershed moment of like, oh, I don't know what's going on here. There's something so much bigger than what I know is going on. And so that at least gave me enough to pause and to be like, oh, what what I think of as good news in the public sphere, the way that I conceive of social justice, is incomplete. But it took some time for me to start to be able to think about that in any other way. So I did not vote at all from 2008 until 2014, I think. It was either 2012 or 2014. My husband was a political science major, and so it drove him crazy. He was like, what do you mean you're not going to vote? But I couldn't figure it out. And there was also this like big narrative, and I think you still see this, although it's less prevalent now, but this whole like, well, Jesus is king. We don't need to swear our allegiance to a political party, and so we just won't vote because that's like the most Christian approach, because neither party is perfect, neither major party is perfect. And so I really bought into that in a big way, to be like, well, I don't want to like tie my morality to either party. You know, which in some ways I feel like it's a stepping stone. It's an important stepping stone in deconstructing the idea that like the only Christian way to vote is to vote Republican, which is what I grew up with. But also it was also a stepping stone that I was afforded on the basis of my immense amount of privilege as a white, straight, able-bodied, married woman. It was as I started to see the effects of local policy in real time happening in my neighborhood in Milwaukee. That was, you know, during the time that Scott Walker was the governor of Wisconsin, and he ran for president in 2016. So people got to see a little bit about his approaches to policy during that time. And so, yeah, kind of seeing in real time what these policy decisions in Madison, Wisconsin were doing in my neighborhood in Milwaukee, and getting to a point where I was like, I can't love my neighbor and not vote.
So this shift that you were going through, both at a theological level and a political and kind of praxis level, was this largely private, or was this something that the folks you grew up with in church and your family and your friends from college were aware of and witness to?
I'm an extrovert, like a lot. Like I had started this blog to write about our ministry to the kids in the neighborhood and to share recipes, and like then kind of over time started writing more and more about like the questions I was asking and the different things I was wrestling with. And I got a lot of like messages from people who were like, hey, I really love the ministry you're doing, but I'm concerned about your politics. And even seeing the way that people would distinguish those things of like, hey, I love that you are like running an after school program or like helping like provide like wraparound like literacy resources or whatever for these kids in your neighborhood, but can you just tone down the political stuff? And I want to be like, you not understand that like school funding is a policy issue? Yes, it was public. Is the long and short of that.
How do you understand the reaction of people who give you praise for doing ministry work, or people who I'm going to assume would have praised the public evangelism that you did in California, but who get uncomfortable when you draw connections from that work to systems and to ways to alleviate suffering that go beyond a one-on-one relationship?
I think that's complicated. And if I had a down-pat answer to that question, I probably would have written a different book than the one I wrote. That's why I did write the book with this like eye to the story that forms us, and then use the like framework of like unlearning and returning. Because I think that for so many people, being able to praise one set of actions or behaviors or values and condemn something that is connected without really seeing that has to do with, we're all formed by a story. We all have been given a set of beliefs and practices And for many of us, if we grew up in white evangelical spaces, everything was very deeply personal. Personal salvation, personal witness, personal holiness. And so the connections just weren't there. There are no neural pathways for that. I am more compassionate now than I was 10 years ago. That's not to say that I'm extremely compassionate to that position, but more so than I used to be. I think that there are a number of people who are starting to become more aware of that. That's something I've seen over the last 4 years during the Trump administration, of people starting to see in increasing numbers that all of that is connected, that that all relates. And so for the people in my life who don't see those connections, there are people who would praise me for one thing, but not the other. At this point, I would try to ask more questions and try to dig down to like what values are motivating their actions and how they are seeing the Lord work in the world, how they are discerning the Spirit moving, and then try to build from there. Again, like when all of this stuff was first happening, when I was in the middle of deconstructing or reconstructing things for the very first time, I was still really defensive, and there was a lot of trying to find the posture of like, I'm going to prove that I'm right. And if I am right loud enough at you, then you will see that I'm right. And I'm just, you know, so I regret some of the ways that I carried myself then. I just use it as a reminder to try to stay curious now, not only about my own beliefs, because like heaven help me if I think that I've arrived now, but also to remember that like at one point I was also the person who couldn't hold those things together. Like at one point I was also the person who was just like, well, I think social justice is good, but it should just stay out of the voting booth, right? And so I am less concerned these days with trying to prove that I'm right and more concerned with trying to help us all ask better questions. And specifically for people who, like me, grew up white evangelical, to say we were given a really incomplete story. Like we have a whole lot of gaps that we need to fill in. And in some instances, in my instance for sure, entire paradigm shifts that need to occur for us to truly follow Jesus and encounter the risen and resurrected and ascended Lord. Because at the end of the day, I'm still a huge church kid. I'm still a huge Bible nerd. Like I still believe all this stuff. And it's because I do that I've had to find a new way. Because the path that I was set on was incomplete and was misleading.
Yeah, I have been noticing, and I think this is, it's a good quality, that there is a humility in people who have been going through a process of unlearning and deconstructing. And yet, it sometimes concerns me that the consequences of toxic theology are real. And as you say, they are felt much more strongly by people who are not in our privileged position. And there is an urgency that I wish could mesh better with the humility, because I think a lot of folks go through kind of disillusionment and then a withdrawal, like you describe, from politics in general. And it's the building up of a positive and compassionate way to live out your values that can be such a challenge, is figuring out, okay, I don't want to be that obnoxious person telling everybody what to believe, but part of improving the lives of my neighbors is going to be going and getting my fellow white women and talking to them about what I believe now, and trying to ask these questions and shift the frames that some people have, give them new pathways, as you put it. What are some ways of reconciling those two important approaches?
Am I supposed to be an expert on this now because I wrote a book on it.
That is the rule.
Oh, no.
Did no one tell you?
I did not know that that was part of it. I don't know, because it's true, right? Like, even as I'm saying, like, I don't want to scream at people and we need to be more curious and things like that. Like, the reality is, like, no, there is this profound urgency, right? And the anger and the frustration and the mourning that came out of so many people after the 2016 election who were just like, we have been telling you. So many, I feel like, particularly Black women who were just like, but we have been trying to tell you. Like, why were you not listening? I don't know always how to navigate all of that in terms of, like, conversations with other white women, trying to start asking the question of, like, what would success look like in this conversation? What would be the next step for this person? I think can be helpful. There are people that I would talk to that it's like, no, I need you to vote, right? Like, you have been working through this stuff. You've been, like, rolling these ideas around in your head for years now. And this year, I'm going to need you to actually vote. Like, I'm going to need you to go to the ballot box. And then there's other people who are starting to ask questions for the very, very first time. Success looks like different things in different conversations because people are at different places and are ready to engage in different topics. How do I help this person ask the next best question is helpful instead of feeling like it has to be all or nothing. I can hold your hand while you walk through this. And we're going to keep walking. Like, it's going to be like when you walk with a toddler through a parking lot. Like, we're going to keep moving. We are not just going to stand here. But I will hold your hand and walk you through this because it is difficult. Those are difficult conversations. And my privilege allows me the space to say, I will keep holding your hand and keep trucking you through this parking lot. And it will be hard and it will be exhausting, but it is different type of exhaustion because of my social location.
I really like the way you ask for this person with this conversation, what would be the next good step? What would be a successful outcome? And taking it one step at a time in terms of a relationship, because those are the kind of conversations that are meaningful. One of the ways that we talk about it with Vote Common Good, which I've been involved with this year, is thinking of it as the prodigal son. Just because you come to it later, could we have used your help earlier? Yes, but you're here now. So where do we go from here?
Mm-hmm. I really like to practice, like, subversive curiosity, talking to people in your neighborhood who are like, well, if this development happens, if this apartment complex gets put in, then... well, that'll attract certain types of people. Well, what kind of people? Like, no, if you're going to have a viewpoint that says, I don't want these apartments in my community because it's going to bring low-income families into our community or whatever, then I need you to say that out loud. Like, if you're going to have that value, then you're going to own it in this space, and I am not going to let you just continue to have that value tucked away and, like, hidden in your heart so that you can feel really good about yourself while you have this oppressive or exploitative value that is kind of lurking. No, we're going to say it out loud. And that doesn't mean that I have to fix it today, because we don't fix those things, and we cannot fix other people. As my therapist likes to remind me, we can't fix other people. But if you say it out loud, so many monumental shifts in my life came from hearing myself say something out loud and realizing I didn't like what came out of my own mouth.
I want to repeat those last words from Megan. So many monumental shifts in my life came from hearing myself say something out loud and realizing I didn't like what came out of my own mouth. Man, what an honest, tough, and yet compassionate observation there. The kinds of deeper conversations that come from asking questions we might ordinarily sidestep are why we started This Is My Story. We know nobody needs more debates using Twitter arguments or Fox News talking points. But we also can't afford to let some fear-driven ends justify the means ideas go unchallenged. Women have been particularly socialized to pretend that they just didn't hear something ugly, or to smile and let it slide. Now, we're not here to make you feel bad about that. So many of us have spent our entire lives being rewarded and praised for those behaviors, and punished when we respond otherwise. Sometimes letting things slide is literally the way we avoid physical danger. But it is past time to learn how to probe deeper in conversations with friends and family, to get to their underlying values, and as Megan says, force people to say out loud what they would often prefer to leave as subtext. That's our show for this week. Thank you for listening, and please subscribe to Impolite Company wherever you listen to podcasts. We invite you to continue the conversation at thisismystoryproject.com. We would love to hear your story.